Cage.
Ladies and gentlemen, Zebra Stripes Podcast. I'm Coach Gene Clemens, joined as always by Coach Whit Lejeune of Bridgeton Academy. Coach Whit, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Certainly a lot better than this past weekend. So,
yeah, I know the bugs are real out there, right? The bugs that are hitting America is not like just some propaganda. It's a real thing.
Yeah, I think I'm on the front end of what I've heard Lester Holt call the triple-demic. And so hopefully I got my little dose of whatever the hell that was that knocked me on my keister. And I've talked to enough coaches out there in different parts of the country when you tell them, yeah, I'm battling, a little sick. There's a lot of sickness out there. And one particular coach was honest enough to say, yeah, I probably had COVID, but just didn't go about the testing process and made it through the weekend. So I thought to myself, that's interesting, because that would be unheard of, unthinkable just a couple of short years ago. It seems to me, without being political about it, that, COVID might be like the least of our problems right now, or at least it's only one of several.
Well, I think like every bug, every disease, it all depends on who you are, right? Who you are, what you're predetermined to. I would still say COVID's probably a big deal for those who have those markers that say COVID's really going to hit you hard. So if you're diabetic, if you're from a history of heart issues and blah, 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 COVID is probably still more something you're dealing with, because you know how it can affect those in a more severe way. But I think there's also this interesting part of, where did the flu go? Like, the flu disappeared for 2 years, and now all of a sudden the flu is back with a vengeance. And to me, it says, well, maybe some of these things that we were calling COVID during the COVID times were actually just the flu. But because there were so many overlapping, there were so many overlapping markers that both had, that we were just willing to call it COVID because that was convenient. So I'm happy to see that you're on the mend. I hope that all of the teams out there, all of the coaches out there, are doing everything that they can to keep their players and themselves healthy. We all know that when it comes to the flu, at least, the chain of how a flu can get passed through your team can cripple your team for 2 to 3 weeks, when it comes. So partly good for you guys that this is happening around Thanksgiving time, where you've got a few, you've got a few days to kind of, hey, go in your room, separate, or go home and, kind of work through this thing and then come back, as opposed to if you were right in the thick of things right now and you were running these things through the entire team.
Absolutely right.
One of the things that we look at it as far as, but what we do is, this is obviously a basketball pod, but we delve into football, we delve into other sports, we delve into life, and we definitely talk a lot about coaching. And I think one of the things that we can't get too far into this podcast without bringing up is the Louisville Cardinal basketball team and their new head coach, Kenny Payne, who is a 17-year NBA veteran as a coach, and is now dipping his toe into, well, not dipping, dove head first into college athletics. But the results have not been something that people are like, oh my gosh, this is really good. And I've heard people already on the brink of, hey, was this the right hire? Is this something that we should probably revisit. What's making it harder, I think, for Kenny Payne, quite honestly, is the fact that Mike Woodson in Indiana, I would say a program that if we were being objective about it, at its height was probably on the same level, right? Not like if we dismiss the past of what Indiana basketball used to be and just look at where they are right now, I think that the heights of Louisville are probably similar to the heights of Indiana. And yet Mike Woodson has been able to come into an Indiana program and they look really, really good out, really, really strong out the gate. And unfortunately for Kenny Payne in Louisville, it's not looked good at all. It's looked really, really bad. And culminating with an embarrassing loss. We'll just say an embarrassing loss that they suffered here over the last couple of days.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's really one embarrassing loss either. I think there's been a couple, and you know, just the how bad the defeats have been have obviously been what's striking. I don't, you know, I think it's caught everyone's attention. Obviously, I don't know enough about the specifics of what he inherited. Obviously, Louisville's been hit with NCAA sanctions and other things. So he did not go into a cupboard that was well stocked versus, say, in Indiana, which years ago had gone through some of that. You know, Kelvin Sampson had actually stopped in for a cup of coffee and had some problems. But I think Indiana was more well positioned as Woodson came in. So I just think what I saw from Fran Fraschilla is about the most even balanced view of the thing, which is regardless of how good a coach, head coach Kenny Payne might be, and regardless of what that cupboard looked like when he entered in, you would expect that someone with that pedigree, level of connection to the NBA, Nike, college athletics, etc., would have done better in the transfer portal market. And I again, full disclosure, I've been meaning to, but I haven't even looked at who Louisville's, who he hired as assistants and any of that. It's just like, wow, you can't get off to a worse start than the one that they have. And the final reflection I got on it is, well, you know, we all have seen and now know the story of Coach K and some of the other folks that back in the day, you know, if that had been another time, might not have had the chance to turn things around. So it's almost so strikingly bad that, okay, well, you know, it can only go one direction and, you know, see what happens. So it's eye popping though. There's no question about that.
I think it's going to take a strong and resolute athletic director and president, because both of those guys have to be lockstep in this, right? To say, hey, listen, we understand that what Kenny Payne came into was not an ideal situation. We knew this was going to be a multi-year rebuild. We're going to rock with them. But I don't think in their wildest dreams they thought that it would look like this, right? And so the problem that I have is talent is one thing. And so you can forgive a team for not having the level of talent requisite to compete against your contemporaries, against the ones within conference and what you're going to do and blah, 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 blah. What you can't forgive though is the coaching with the talent. And so what the perception would be is, well, you can't get these guys to perform any better than that, dot, dot, dot. And I think that that's where a lot of the Kenny Payne backlash is going to come from. It's like, okay, we'll give you that you might not have the level of talent that, well, that you don't have the level of talent that Kentucky has, that you don't have the level of talent that Georgia has, or that LSU has, or that Florida has, Missouri, so on and so forth. But you're struggling to beat South Carolina State.
Right.
Which has a roster full of brand new kids that just came to South Carolina State this year, that has a brand new coach like you. Is this a situation where you just don't understand how to maneuver and process the college game as a head coach, as opposed to what you might have been able to do had this been the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, the games are different. And so, excuse me. I do think that that's one of the intriguing parts of so many of these hiring processes in football as well as basketball, which is to say, who are the guys that successfully change levels, you know, go from high school to college, college to the pros, right? And it doesn't work quite a bit, but it then does work really well sometimes. So I think there's that issue. There's another coaching cliche about, you know, teams that are successful in the early season are the teams that had the best preseason. So the teams that put in the best work or the most work, or, you know, in the fall, say, that pans out in the early season games. I mean, it could be that Kenny Payne and his staff was so hell-bent on the road recruiting this fall leading up to this early season that their team is maybe a little bit less ready than some others. You know, hard to say. Look at here, Kenny Payne's not alone. Like I mentioned this to you a couple weeks ago. There, I don't have the numbers, but there's been more upsets already this year, and there continue to be. I was looking last night again. More than I can ever remember in past history. Leonard Hamilton down at Florida State. I think they finally won, but they were 0-3 with some god-awful losses. And, I mean, again, he's not alone. I mean, there were some of the I think I have a – at one point I – yeah, no, I had a list.
I'm with you. There has been a lot of upsets, but when you lose 70-38 to Texas Tech, who has in itself probably think that they've underachieved already early in the season.
When you lose
70-38 to Texas Tech, that's going
like,
to be something that goes, oh my gosh, like what's going on?
I like that loss better than Cleveland State losing to Notre Dame College. Okay, or Florida State losing to Stetson. I mean, the score, you know, that, oh my goodness, God. How about California? UCal, since Konzo left, has done nothing except lose. They can't win a game.
And that's been years now.
How the heck, like this year, they are, and this is Mark Fox, who had a lot of success at Nevada, took the money at Georgia and couldn't get a ton done. Now he's out at Cal Berkeley.
Who's gotten it done at Georgia, right? That's the thing.
Well, I mean, Hugh Durham.
What has he done?
Hugh Durham?
Yeah.
He was a legendary coach at Georgia, but
– No, I'm saying, like, we're talking about right now, like recently, over the last –
I'm just saying Georgia has won. Who won at Georgia a little bit, right? Wasn't Harrick winning a little bit and ran into trouble, right? I mean, that's just
okay.
Georgia, you can win at Georgia, but I mean,
you should 100%. My point is, you should 100% be able to win at Georgia because Georgia has an underrated pool of talent in the state, right? Yeah. There's an underrated pool of talent in the state. And you've seen Georgia State have success. You've seen Georgia Tech win in the right positioning, be able to have success. you wonder why a school with all of the resources in the world, like the University of Georgia, can't have some level of sustained success.
Well, and they're not. That's,
we've seen a few coaches now.
Right, but that's my point with all the upsets that again show the parity in football as well as basketball. I think some of these stand out. So the Florida State situation to me stands out. The UCal situation stands out. Losing is one thing and getting off to a bad start or not having a great year. But when major universities who commit enormous amounts of resources fail at a level that is just striking, that's where it catches your attention. You go, huh, you know. And obviously around here for years, Boston College was facing that. And again, not to put Boston College in a Louisville or Florida State conversation, but Boston College may be equivalent to like a Cal, where there are perhaps stronger academic standards and some of that thing, not the same all-in commitment to winning. But at a certain point when you're losing all the time, it raises serious questions. So it's not the losing, it's the extent of the losing, and particularly at major universities that seemingly are in positions not to have to negotiate that. It's a whole different can of worms for the average mid-major school that, you know, is fighting for its life, cash strapped anyway, and a high powered hoops or football team kind of opens the admissions door, Florida Gulf Coast or something like that. Those places look at can catch lightning in a bottle, and, you know, awfully good things can happen, but they also are going to have a hard time maybe sustaining some of that, right? And the ones that do, are viewed as the model. Gonzaga way back when for what it did. Vermont now on its own level, although Vermont is struggling. Look at that, 1-5, lost again by 30 to Yale on the road. And that caught my attention. And I've had my head into my own situation enough that I'm not, you know, I have not yet taken a deep dive into this more. I'm hoping our guest can tell us a bit more about what might be going on with some of these programs.
Yeah, I think I've noticed a lot just because I've been kind of in tune, just looking through games with my one pick college basketball one pick daily challenge. And it just seems to be that I say it, and I know I go back to it a lot. The people who are able to navigate this new world with this extra year that gives you these super seniors, these super duper seniors, and being able to navigate these sixth or fifth and sixth, and in some cases, seventh year guys who could still play basketball for you has made a lot of difference. It's been normal that HBCUs were kind of like pick on the HBCUs, and some of these HBCUs are just like, nah, we're here to play ball, because they're bringing in quote unquote veteran talent. And I think that's to the point of your, Arkansas Pine Bluff calls early in the year being competitive and almost upsetting some big name teams, and then being competitive versus some other teams where you've seen in the past they might get blown out. Their roster's just full of guys who played a lot of basketball, and that can't be ignored. And so when you're a Vermont and you're sticking to the formula that's been good for you for a really long time now, and now all of a sudden these other teams are using this new metric, this new formula, this new way, you're going to have to play that string out until it's no longer the case, or you're going to have to change some things up in the way in which you recruit.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think you're right on as far as what the role of that graduate transfer is, but I also think that's compounded by the transfer portal and the fact that all these teams can be sabotaged from within in a moment's notice with a bunch of guys leaving. Therefore, you know, again, the wrong guys leaving hurt one team, the right guys coming in help the new team. So I think it's that combination of both of those things, navigating a far more fluid team structure than ever before. How to negotiate your roster.
Absolutely. And while we, you know, while we're talking about it, it's perfect timing. Why don't you introduce our guest today, because we have a great young man joining us, a guy who is a Bridgeton Academy alumni. Tell us more about him.
Damien, how are you, man?
I'm good. I'm good. Happy to be on. I don't know if I can do the first time, long time on a pod, but I'll do it. So.
Okay. Well, the bottom line, Damien Farley, Natick High legend, 2,000 point score, 02 graduate, is 02. Is that the way we call it, or 01?
What are, 02. What, yeah.
Yeah. 02.
I think you inflated my scoring a bit, but I used to be able to make shots.
could buckets galore. Then a very, very, stellar career at Springfield under recently retired Charlie Brock. And I always say this, Damien, I'm not trying to put you on the spot either. We've had some great Bridgeton guys, period. And then I've been lucky enough to coach some tremendous young men, right? But no one has been any more loyal to the cause, if you will. And that's just not to yours truly or the Hoops. That's to the whole mission of what Bridgeton's out all about. So I'm not selling that. I'm just saying that, you know, it was years ago I was informed about the incredibly small percentage of scholarship athletes at the Division I level that give back to their schools. And that shocked me, frankly. The numbers are interesting. And so as a postgraduate school, you know, we always struggle a bit in the development office, if you will, with getting people involved in that part of the deal. And as everyone, as we all know here, it's not whether you give a buck or $1 million. It's do you give a shit enough to do something? And so Damien does. That's the highest praise I can give him. And then beyond that, him and I, from time to time, have some great conversations that mean the world to me. And so this is tremendous to have him with us on this. So there you go.
Absolutely. And welcome, Damien. And I would just say this. Obviously, if Witt's talking, you know Coach Witt well enough that he's not just blowing smoke up the glutes about people he doesn't really feel strongly about. And so if Coach Witt is speaking that highly of you, then obviously, you know, it must be well deserved. I will jump you in on this. We've been talking about all of the upsets that we've seen in college basketball early in the season. And I was talking about the super duper transfer that we have right now, because you have that extra year from the NCAA that's allowing these guys to play anywhere between 6 and 7, you know, extra years of time in college. Do you think that that's a part of why we've seen so many of these upsets of teams that we believe are normal powers, or is it just one of those crazy years where, you know, anything can happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I've been giving that some thought lately too, because I think with COVID, it has sort of exacerbated the transfer portal on a completely different level. And I sort of remember going back to when I was in college, and actually I got to go back and read the book. And I was lucky enough to play with a guy named Carlos Rivera with Coach Witt. And he was on some really great Hofstra teams. And it was around the time that this book came out about the rise of the mid-major. And it coincided with George Mason's run to the Final Four. And, you know, the rise there was because the one and done was sort of killing the high major programs. And so I think evaluating talent and recruiting is extremely difficult. Guys get overlooked, underlooked, whatever have you. And so, you know, going back to that time in the early 2000s, you know, you had these one and done programs, and it allowed programs like your George Masons, like your Wichita States, you know, they could really develop talent, and kids were staying for 3 and 4 years. Now I think what you have here is, I don't even know how to describe it best, but with the transfer portal in this COVID year, you know, it's almost like a different version of that, in my opinion, because a lot of these kids are older and you win with experience. So, you know, for example, I'm kind of a hoops junkie, and I was looking at St. Michael's roster the other day, because in Division II up here, they're actually off to a 4-0 start. They have a kid on there that's a sophomore or junior that's at his fourth college. So, like, some of this stuff is kind of funny. It's tough to keep track of, especially as a college basketball fan with so much roster turnover. I think it's a big reason right now why all this stuff's going on, or why these upsets are happening, I think. So.
And I think the NCAA, this is coming from a college coaching friend of mine. I mean, the NCAA has been more lenient about eligibility issues during since COVID than at any other time previously. I mean, they have almost turned a blind eye to everything. And by that, I mean transcripts on the way in from high schools, right? Prep schools used to get a lot of attention. Transcripts from colleges to colleges. I mean, there's just waivers being granted everywhere. The only thing I'll say in this conversation is when I listen to Eugene, it's like these guys at the Division I level are able to play 8 or 9 years. That's not true. I mean, you do have 5 years to play four by rule, and with a clock starting. Now the question is, okay, when they grant a sixth year, okay, I'm not aware of anyone at the Division I level who's getting out beyond that. So it's not the wild, wild west where someone's in school for 8 years or something like that. I mean, that is not
Let me defend myself real quick, Whit, because I said 6 to 7 years, right? So yep. I'm right in that mode. I said six to 7 years, and if you look at the University of Georgia football team right now, they have a 25-year-old quarterback. He didn't start football late. He didn't wait to come to college. He came to college directly out of high school. And because of circumstances and how things have gone, and that extra year that allowed him 6 years to play five instead of 5 years to play four, he's been able to stretch that out, and now he's 25 years old as the starting quarterback for the University of Georgia. Once the University of Tennessee has a 24 going on 25-year-old quarterback. So we see this more and more, and that's in football where we haven't seen the transfer portal be as weaponized as we've seen in college basketball for more than just right now. This is college basketball jumped on it much earlier, especially on the women's side with transfers, and then the men's side now coming about. But they've been earlier to the party before college football got to it. And so my point is that you're getting a situation where some of these teams who would normally get pillaged by bigger schools for their players, able to then go and snatch players from another school and bring them in. And the result is a lot of veteran talent, whereas your high major schools are still beholden to the, we're trying to bring in the top recruiting class. And that doesn't always come with bringing in the 22-year-old graduate transfer from Hofstra that can shoot.
I believe everything you've said up to that point. I was with you everywhere until you went there, because by your own argument, I would say, look, at the high major program is in a position to take the most advantage of everything you're talking about. So that's another way in which it stands to reason that they would benefit more from all of this than the lower levels, and why, again, the upsets are catching my attention because, yes, I agree with you. It's parity. There's parity and competitive balance. So that to me is the answer. But it's just shocking what some of the schools, in my opinion, with resources, and we started it with the conversation of Louisville. It's just shocking how they're playing early in the season.
They are able to take advantage of it more, but they're not, because to a certain extent, the recruiting class and bringing in the guy that's going to the league matters more to Kentucky than bringing in the guy that can fill a need as we need a 3-point shooter. So it's like, do I lean into bringing in these grown men and trying to win games, because that helps me win games? Or do I lean into bringing in these kids who are possibly going to go to the NBA because I think that's going to be better for our long-term recruitment out of high school?
Right, and I'll let Damian chime in first, but I'm going to tell you, you lean into both of those things. You lean into what Damian said earlier, which is to say you lean into the player that you think is going to help you the most, and all of these people know we're in a win now world. You know, what have you done for me lately? So you calculate your risk and you say, okay, and you just assemble the most talent you can that makes the most sense given whatever the heck your landscape is. So anyway, that's my two cents.
No, and I think too, Gene, you touched on it. What is interesting right now with these high major programs is they are shifting to that model. Like, you look at Georgetown. I got a kick out of Georgetown this year because, you know, I went up on their website and they announced big recruiting class, but it was 7 transfers. So you're getting some of that. Calipari's now taking on transfers. I mean, Tashidwe is a West Virginia kid. Kellen Grady was a star player at Davidson. Bill Self, who I think you could argue is probably the best coach in college basketball right now, he's trickling in a couple transfers. I mean, he had the point guard from Arizona State on that national title team last year. So, I think the only one that really Duke has kind of abstained a little bit, but they had Theo John from Marquette, who was more sex appeal than actual player. So, but to Witt's point, I think the high major thing right now is really interesting because you've got to find a way to balance, like you said, those 5-star McDonald's All-American guys, but then sort of taking into account the current landscape of this transfer portal.
I've got a question for you, Damian. I laid this on Gene several weeks ago and got a very, very – I got chastised pretty good for it. But does the NIL play a role at all in any of this? So the idea, I first made that comment in relation to the football upsets that were going on, which is to say it's the first time, right? Coaches have always had to deal with boosters who were paying guys. And in the famous words of Bob Boyd at Mississippi State, good luck getting someone in a defensive stance who you're paying, right? And it's a little bit harder. So now that you've got all this NIL stuff, you know, is that playing a role in team chemistry, in individual motivation? I'd be curious on the inside, and I'm absolutely serious as to how coaches are navigating it, and if they've seen a change in player approach or how they have to approach the players themselves with guys that are, you know, for the first time, just flat out getting paid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it's definitely having – I'd be curious because having listened to the show, and I know Coach Gene's background with college football, and my brother Griffin is a huge college football fan and big Florida football fan, and so he's pretty well-versed on a lot of this stuff. I think it's had a big impact on college football, specifically Texas A&M. I think Saban was trying to play a game of chess early on with – you know, at his booster meeting, if you will, to say, you know, they're just disguising NIL deals. I don't know. You know, I think it's a good question. I think it could be. I mean, with college football, it's different, right? Because there's just the roster size is so much bigger than hoops. But I think it could. I don't know if you and I had this conversation with, but like I was talking to my brother about this last year. Georgia, their starting quarterback had signed an NIL deal with a local car dealership for like $50,000. And then he got benched for the Stetson kid. So now it's like, if I'm the car dealership and I just dished out $50,000 for this guy to play, and now you're benching him for this guy. And it's like, meanwhile, you're Kirby Smart. You're going like, well, I got to win here because that's the business I'm in. And this kid gives us the best chance. But now are you welcoming in more are you bringing in more risk to your program? I think with football, it's probably more difficult to track just because it's such a big roster. But, yeah, I think
what No, I love that. That's great. In basketball, the only thing – the reason I bring it up in part, okay, for a long time, I've observed college basketball occasionally looking a little bit like the local horse track. And that is to say, from I'm not saying scandal and cheating and all that. I'm saying that every once in a while, blue blood thoroughbred teams occasionally appear to throw one and be perfectly fine with it to teams that you'd never expect getting beat. I've just watched some teams give a half-hearted effort and just shake the hands of some low major guys that were extremely excited to beat him and just say like, hey, listen, nice win. But by the way, I've got a Jaguar over here in the parking lot that when this game's over, I'm driving out in. And it's just, so I, it's all, I, I'm just, to me, it's that lingering thought in my mind on steroids that, you know, that if you're a coach, you're a boy, are you navigating an incredibly dynamic landscape in your locker room? That's just idle speculation by me.
Oh, I think you're on to something there. I mean, I would just drop this here. I mean, Kentucky St. Peter's. I mean, you know, St. Peter's, you talk about some dog, and you got Kentucky. I don't know. You got guys thinking about draft stock. Hey, I don't know what type of deals they have on the side that they're getting. I mean, have they been fluffed up too much? I don't know.
Damien, are we going to let the coaches off the hook on those things?
No,
We're talking about players making thousands of dollars. These coaches are making millions.
Yep.
So are we going to let the coaches off the hook?
In what sense?
Some of these L's as well?
Like in what sense?
Well, because Witt's thought process, and Witt, you can chime in if you think that I'm misrepresenting what you're saying, is that these players are comfortable, right? They've gotten some money. Somebody, so they're okay with the L, because they're getting paid now, right? But that's a, but even within any sport, not just football, basketball as well, that's still a small percentage. Now, as we all know, because we've seen how the sausage is made, they've been getting paid. Those upper echelon elite guys have been finding their way to the money while they're still in college. So, but these coaches' salaries now, Calipari isn't pressed to beat St. Peter's because he's already made a mint and he's going to make a mint. And his buyout is a mint. And if he gets bought out by Kentucky, guess who's going to want him? Every program in the country. So is he coaching as hard as he could? Like, if we're going to say that the players are now maybe not taking it as seriously or not as invested as they were, can't we say the same thing about the coaches? And haven't we been able to say that about the coaches for years now?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair point. I will say that to you right there. I think it's a fair point. And so I think you did not misrepresent me. I would just say again, I would emphasize my side of it, that the total environment, coaches included, is a far more dynamic environment than it once was. And I think you raise a good point. And I also think, right, any honest coach will tell you, you don't do the same job. Just like a player, you never stay the same, right? You get better, you get worse. A coach, you don't do the same job every year. Just because John Calipari did a good job last year doesn't mean he's doing a good one this year, and vice versa. And occasionally you'll hear a coach actually take responsibility. And when you do, it's kind of refreshing at any level to hear it. But
yep.
So I think you're right. I just think it adds to the complexity of trying to, like, this is what Damian, I think, and I were talking about actually yesterday, trying to achieve a consistent elite level performance. You know what we were talking about, Damian? It's partly.
Yeah, I think so. I just think we were also just talking about how hard it is to win on a consistent level. And I think right now it's really tough, you know, and I agree with what you said, Gene. And I think in a perfect world, you don't let the coaches off the hook. But I think also in a perfect world, the first guys to get snapped to get fired are the coaches and the ADs. And I take it a step further. I forget which personality said this. It might even have been Jay Billis. I'd fire the presidents or some of these other people because you don't pull the – I don't think anybody on this podcast right now has the wool pulled over their eyes. Like, they're not all in – they're all in cahoots. Like, let's like cut the shit a little bit. You know what I mean? It's big money. Sure. And it's – I think we all – you know, we all know what we're – I think a lot of those guys know what they're signed up for, you know, so –
just and I want to transition because I know we want to talk about a little bit more than just this, but just imagine for a second, right? University of Tennessee has made this quantum leap up the ladder of relevance in football behind a quarterback who is 24 years old. He still has another year to play. Like, Hendon Hooker has played 4 seasons legitimately. He can come back because of the COVID year exemption. He can come back next year at 25 years old and play another season. Tennessee's not beating Alabama or LSU without Hendon Hooker. If they've just got a guy that they recruited, that's a good guy, most likely he's not beating LSU and Tennessee. They've been able to beat LSU, number 5 or 6 ranked in the country right now. Alabama, who's number 8 ranked in the country right now, and at that time was still in the top 4. They've been able to beat those 2 teams this year because they have a talent at 24 years old that they would have never been able to have had not it been for the advent of the transfer rule that doesn't allow them to sit out a year, and for the you have an extra year to play. I completely believe that changes the dynamic of some of these teams when you look at the level of guys who are playing. I just take me for an example. Me at 22 years old playing football versus me at 18 years old playing football, me at 22 playing basketball versus me at 18 playing basketball, at 19 year old me athleticism versus 18 year old me athleticism was already ridiculous. But at 22, even at 24, when I was starting, when my knees were starting to break down, I could still dunk on people. Like, I was at Brishton Academy giving Brishton Academy upper level kids issues at 24 with bad knees. So, like, the idea that an athlete can be 24 and 25 years old, which for those who don't break down early, is probably into the peak years of their career. Now they're spending that in college instead of in the pros or in some other professional ranks, or, by the way, past their prime because they couldn't play until they were 24. So now they're at a desk at a 9-to-5 job. I think that's immeasurable almost.
Well, beyond your terrific biography, which you laid out, I would simply say that hockey, in the sport of hockey, that 23, 24 year old kid is like an average age. I mean, anytime we tend to dwell on football and basketball here. I said this back when I was at New Hampton school in the early 80s, and they were a national powerhouse in hockey and all this sort of stuff. I know for a fact, well, I'm going to take out fact. I believe strongly hockey is as dirty is I used to call it the dirtiest of them all. Let's just put it that way. That was my belief then. As dirty as people believe basketball and football was, hockey was dirtier. And the reason it doesn't get the same level of scrutiny is because there's not as much money involved in it. And the color of the people playing it is like ghostly white. So, and you look at it today, what hockey eligibility is like at the NCAA level is absolutely ridiculous, and the routes they take to get there. So, and then I do question a little bit, by the way, I think the aging, the prime age of athletes has now gone up. We all know that people's prime is, people are able to achieve a prime for either longer or later or whatever. But anyway. I digress.
Yeah.
I digress.
I think you were taking a shot at me about my
I'm just saying, I wasn't certain exactly where you're going, but I did enjoy the trip down memory lane and you apparently having your way with some of my guys and
I was 100% giving your elite level, yeah. So first of all, Damian.
Let me ask you this, Whit. Who had better hops, Coach Gene or Donnie Hale?
Well, it's hard to compare the 6'5", athlete guy to the 6'9" guy. Yeah.
I'm 6'4". I had bunnies. And I wasn't carrying like 185 pounds. Like by the time I got to Brishton, I was a tight end. So I was a legit 255, 260, and had bunnies for the record. And we blew out as a Brishton alum, and we can get into some Brishton stuff. As a Brishton alum, like dorm.
And
dorm wars, Masty took the crown. Intern that year.
If that's what this pod is turning into, then I'm going to invite guests, with all due respect to Damian, that go back in time to my, heydays, and they're going to talk about what the hell I was doing in the gym and all that sort of stuff. So.
I'll tell you this, the 3-on-3 tournament, that'd be the 3-on-3 story with Coach Witt and Alex Johnson would be a story.
I can only imagine
off the air over a gin and tonic. Okay, because
can only imagine his level of competitiveness. He was really in his like go getter days.
Elbows leisure, man. Elbows leisure.
For sure. And unapologetic about the elbows as well, by the way.
Oh, he was the only other person in the gym less sorry than him was Al Lewis.
Say less. Trust me, I understand. We can't even talk about those on the pod, but no, it was a serious thing. And what you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I was at Bridgeton Academy for two of the probably most prominent years of Bridgeton basketball when it came to level of just dudes. They had some dudes. We had one guy, and I can't remember his name right now, but I called him like a bargain basement LeBron James. And Whit was like, you might be right on that. Like, that's how much talent Whit had on a couple of these teams that he was rolling out and just waxing. By the way, teams with other legit talent as well, and pulling out chips. Like, I came through with some dudes, and I was giving them the biz naiz. I'm not here to just toot my own horn, but if we're tooting a horn for a second, I was giving them the business, and I don't want Coach Whit to sell me short on these just because, you know, I'm a football guy by trade.
Yeah,
he knows I'm a basketball guy by heart. You know.
Well, I know that there's a commercial out there. I just saw it the other day, and I can't think of what it's for. But you know, they go to review. The wife goes, "Hey, did you?"
They go to the flag, the red flag. They go to the red flag.
So I'd like to throw the red flag, and I'd like to go to the review, and then we'll all be able to, you know, find the truth there.
Damian, prep back with everything that's happened, prep basketball. And this is one of the things I wanted to get into with Whit about. Prep basketball, I believe, will have a resurgence because of all of the things that we are experiencing at the collegiate level. With the advent of transfers, and with transfers being a lot more fluid, and with this extra year that's going to go on until 2025, and we exhaust that recruiting class that gets to take advantage of it, I feel like prep schools have an opportunity to take advantage of talent that's maybe not like overlooked, but that just can't fit into Division I programs because they have all of this talent in the pool right now. Is that something that you've seen, that you've observed, that you think might be a thing coming forward?
I think it's a really good observation. And I think you're probably right, because some coaches that I've spoken to in the last year or two, I mean, they just don't have availability on their roster. So I talked to one Division III guy, good Division III program here locally, and I said, "Oh, how'd your recruiting class go?" I said, "Oh, we didn't bring anybody in because they just don't have the room." So I think that's a good point. Whether it'll push kids more to the prep private or even to the junior college level, which isn't as strong as other areas of the country. I know here in Massachusetts, public high school basketball has really been pretty decimated over the last, let's call it, decade, and because a lot of kids have been getting poached to go and reclassify at private schools here locally. So what you have here is the private school basketball here is really good, which includes some local preps, but the public high school basketball has really kind of hit the skids a bit. But yeah, it's getting back to your original point. Prep school basketball in New England, it makes me sad, because when I was at Bridgeton, it was so awesome. You know, it was single A, B, C, and D, and now you got triple A, double A, single. It's wild. So everybody has a prep school, and I know. I don't like in New England or even in prep. I don't know that it's been dormant. You know, so I don't know if resurgence is the right word, but I do think you could see an influx of kids go that route because of what's going on.
It's not a resurgence. That's been that move, as you say, has been going on for the more than a decade, right? And so I think what is out there are families of kids who are potentially good college players at some level that can't find appropriate roster spots or ones that they're willing to accept. So they look for a prep school option because they've heard that that might be, you know, a route to go. But on the other hand, you've also got the prep schools similar to colleges that are in a certain business that are now branding athletics, the youth sport culture, like never before. No different again than the NESCAC, or I've used other examples in this pod where there's so many colleges today running competitive athletic programs that years ago wouldn't have given a dime toward them because they would have poo-pooed it as you know, the jock stuff. So you've got prep schools, look, at doing the same thing. And so there's always been what Max Good referred to as payers and players. Okay. And so in the name of branding, every institution essentially has to figure out what is it trying to do. If you're trying to, you know, make a name for yourself, then you better get the players regardless of cost. And that cost has gone up in order to be good. So what it takes to be a prep school champion in 2022, I will tell you for a fact, is different than what it took to be a prep school champion in 2009, 2001, 1985, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not a good or bad thing, in my opinion. That's my personal belief. It's just the way it is. It's the landscape. I think, back to Damien's point earlier, it is hard to win everywhere for a lot of reasons, but the fundamental reason is the marketplace is extremely competitive because on all sides of it you have significant investment, and that's investment in energy, time, resources, etc. So, you know, in to your point, Gene, the instructive part for me to not take myself off the hook is you're definitely right where money is an object for me. Money's an object because if it wasn't, we'd be out of business or it wouldn't be sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. But what's possible, to your point, is there's got to be more hidden gems than ever. And some of them can pay. Yeah. Okay. Because they just could. So that is the most instructive piece of your argument for me that I definitely agree with. And that obviously, is a key part of what most legitimate prep schools are trying to do, balance everything here we're talking about.
So not a resurgence, probably a wrong word, but just a wider talent pool, maybe?
A phenomenon perhaps triggered by COVID, you know, and a new explosion again triggered by some events. I don't know. I don't have my wordsmith hat on, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I think what you brought up is interesting and probably a lot more accurate as to what I mean by.
Right. And I might add, if I hadn't said it earlier, if there are any folks out there with access to hidden gems, and should they, you know, want to look at Bridgeton Academy, by all means, please do. So yeah, I'm usually good for one shameless plug in episode.
At Whit LeJour, you know, at Whit LeJour on all of your DSPs. I'm interested now, right? Because we talk a lot about the upper level, about FCS. We talk a lot about we talk a lot about major, mid-major, but I want to talk about those secondary levels, D2 and NAIA. You mentioned a program having a guy who'd been to their fourth program and they still had years of eligibility left. That's actually not something abnormal that you see at the lower levels, D2, D3, where you might see a guy. I remember playing with a player who was 28 years old, you know, as a just playing out his last 2 years. It came back to school and played out his last 2 years, 28 years old. Do you think that has shifted that D3 NAIA D2 landscape of what we're dealing with as far as talent goes, where you're seeing a lot more older, a lot more veteran teams at that level? Or do you think it's probably the same as it's been for years now?
Can I take the first crack, Damian?
By all means.
I think, look at everyone's better every level. That's number one. Everyone's better at every level. Okay. Number two, my opinion is back in the day, you saw guys going to multiple schools, and I'm not saying this elitistly, right? I'm just saying it as kind of the way it was. Certain schools would tend to have more transfer-type students just by the nature of those types of schools. It might be a commuter school, might be this school, might be that school, might be a school that people, like a starter school, and people would try to go to a better school. I think today that's what's changed. Like, more selective colleges are seeing kids in and out of their doors, and those same selective, might be called elite colleges, have like retention programs in place, starter programs for freshmen. Like, they're protecting their own students, or trying to protecting their investments like never before. But the reality is they have to deal with the flux of students, which includes athletes going in and out the door at a rate that they never did before. So again, without spelling it out completely, I would say that all colleges are now dealing on the levels you're talking about, D3 say, or two, they're colleges that are dealing with issues that what they might consider to be lesser colleges dealt with, only lesser colleges dealt with previously. That would be my argument, Damian.
That's a good one. I don't know that I have as good of an argument as that. And I would just say too that, and I know you guys have discussed this on the pod before, and I think Witt and I have talked about this. You know, because you're hearing a lot. And COVID certainly was such a unique factor, but you're hearing a lot about, I think there's too much attention and focus on the actual student athletes, maybe not being tough or strong enough to transfer, when, you know, their coaches are just as liable as the players are at times, you know, specifically at a higher level. And I also think that a lot of Division I programs, you know, they're having to project and evaluate talent 2 to 3 years out. And so they just don't get an opportunity to really see how good of a player is or isn't. And, you know, I also think Witt and I talked about this yesterday, was now more than ever character really coming into play, because, you know, and I'm sure some of that plays into all this transfer stuff. I don't know. I think it's probably a little more systemic than and it's, yeah. So I don't think I have a great argument for it, but it's,